A federal government increasingly concerned about radicalisation and homegrown terrorism tearing at the social fabric of Australia. I'm talking not about 2026, but about 2005, though the political circumstances have an eerie resonance. Today we learn a little more about what John Howard's government faced two decades ago with the annual release of hundreds of cabinet documents by the National Archives. They show a government spooked by terrorism in Bali and London and troubled by racial disharmony that boiled over on Cronulla Beach in Sydney. Philip Ruddock was Attorney General in 2005 and a senior member of the Howard Cabinet. Welcome back to Radio National Breakfast and Happy New Year.
And best wishes to you and all your listeners.
Thank you.
We had a good night. I'm pleased it went well.
Yes, well, I'm glad you had an early start despite the good night to come and be with us. Philip Ruddock, 4 years after September the 11th, 3 years after the Bali bombings, Australian lives lost in a second Bali attack, coordinated suicide bombings in London. This was 2005. What was the thinking around the cabinet table about the threat posed by Islamic extremism?
Well, it wasn't just the cabinet, it was the National Security Committee, and it worked very much because of these issues to ensure that we were across as much we could the potential risks that we might face. And when you look at what has happened more recently, I think it demonstrates that you need to be fully supporting your security agencies who are monitoring what is going on in the community, the police who have to be ready and available to help and assist. And I think these tragic events that we've seen more recently demonstrate that allowing the budget for particularly security agencies and police to be largely static was not a sound outcome.
Do you see what happened as a failure?
Look, there are always potential events that will unfold in ways that are unexpected, and I'm not prepared to make a judgment in that sense. All I'm saying is that you need to be adequately preparing your agencies to be able to meet those sorts of issues. And in the context of some of the discussion we're hearing at the moment, I think the extent to which the budgets of agencies like ASIO, the Australian Federal Police, working with state agencies, needs to be very carefully looked at to see whether it was adequate for purpose.
In terms of social cohesion, a cabinet submission from the then Multicultural Affairs Minister John Cobb talked of isolation, alienation and discrimination of Muslims and the failure to create a coherent Australian Muslim identity. How do you believe the nation has responded to those concerns over the past two decades?
Well, I spend a good deal of time still with all of our communities. I meet regularly with representatives of our Jewish community, our Islamic communities, both Sunni and Shia. I have many close friends that I see through their schools, and I encourage them in their activities. And I work with other groups that come from different religions, Buddhists and the like. It's the nature of our society. We have more proportionately of people of different backgrounds than you find in almost any other country in the world. And it does present a challenge, but you need to be inclusive and you need to be ensuring that people are brought along with you and identifying those who are potentially a risk, but you are better able to do it if you're working with the communities and having them providing advice to you in confidence about who might be of concern.
Is that happening sufficiently?
Well, obviously we need to look at those issues, and it's a topical question at the moment as to whether there should be a inquiry wider than just looking at the security agencies themselves. Dennis Richardson's a person I have an utmost respect for, and he will do a very creditable job. But I think a wider inquiry is very necessary to look at these issues. And I think our experience back 20 years ago demonstrates why you need to be focused on these issues and looking at how adequately you're undertaking that task.
you believe a federal royal commission should be held? The Prime Minister should change his mind?
I think you need to be able to walk and chew gum, if you know the term. And it's certainly, in my view, something you can't walk away from, and it's very unhelpful to be suggesting that because you're going to inquire into the way in which the security task has been undertaken, that you shouldn't look at the wider circumstances.
You're listening to Radio National Breakfast. I'm speaking with the former Howard Minister, Philip Ruddock, on the release of cabinet papers from 2005. On the issue of climate change, the cabinet documents show multiple warnings from Treasury that business and other groups didn't see the government's policy approach as certain or sustainable, and that it was potentially hampering investment. Do you think that's a criticism that could still apply to today's Liberal Party?
Look, I think the way in which Treasury look at these issues is somewhat different to the way in which the Cabinet at that time undertook its own inquiries. And if you look at the recommendations that were made by Downer and Campbell, they were, sound and supported by the Cabinet, even though Treasury might be arguing that it should be there should be a tempered view. We didn't sign Kyoto at that time. It was done so shortly afterwards, but we were very much engaged with the international community and believing that Australia should be playing its part. And Treasury's persistent criticism, I think, was proven to be unreliable in that particular instance.
Was the Coalition right to dump net zero emissions from its policy platform?
Look, I'm not going to be commenting on what's happening at the moment. That's for the people who have succeeded me to think about. But I simply make the point that even 20 years ago, we came to a view that there was clear scientific evidence climate was changing, that international temperatures were increasing, and that Australia was more likely to be affected by those issues than other countries, and we ought to be playing our part. If you look at the negative impact that it can have on our cities, our rural areas, our agricultural production, to ignore it, in my view, is not a sound approach.
Has Susan Lee then buckled under pressure?
I'm not commenting on the matters that are being talked about lately.
Can I ask you then about the opposition leader's performance following Bondi then? How have you rated that?
I think she's been very sound in the way in which she has been engaging with the community. I know the community particularly well. I was, as immigration minister, responsible for many of the Russian Jews coming to Australia and settling here in expectation it would be a safer place than the former Soviet Union. And to see what has happened troubles me enormously. I know Rabbi Ullman well, and his son-in-law, I was in fact at his wedding. And so I feel for the community, I grieve for those whose lives have been lost. It's tremendously challenging and difficult for all of us who know the parties involved.
Would you like to see more unity from the federal, between the federal opposition and federal government at this time?
Look, I think the extent to which you can work together is desirable, but you shouldn't compromise on the important issues that have to be addressed.
What did you make of Susan Lee calling out Foreign Minister Penny Wong for, she said, not having shed a tear?
I'm not going to get into personally commenting on ministers' performances. It's a job for the Leader of the Opposition, and if she has identified that as a shortfalling, it's appropriate she should do so.
We're a couple of minutes ahead of the news, but just on another issue that came up in the papers on industrial relations, the government passed its work choices legislation in late 2005. Then Workplace Relations Minister Kevin Andrews warned the cabinet of strong opposition from unions and state governments. Do you think the government of the time underestimated that opposition?
I think John Howard will tell you still that he is of the view that it wasn't necessarily the determining factor in relation to the government's loss. I noticed the historian, Dr. Lee, suggested that it may be the principal reason that the Howard government, after 11 years in office, lost, but it had a record term, if you're looking about it, and few governments have been able to achieve that outcome since. I think the Howard government performed exceptionally well, there are numbers of reasons that people come to a view that it's time, and industrial relations may have been part of it. It may not have been.
Nevertheless, do you think the government would have retained power if work choices wasn't seen as so toxic?
I can't say that. I make the point that when you've been in office for 11 years, it's been a very, very long period of time, and few governments have achieved it. I mean, Howard had to beat Menzies.
And the 20 years, have they gone quickly? Does it seem incredible to you that it's 20 years now?
Well, it does seem a long time ago, but I've very much enjoyed my continuing role in public life. It's only recently come to an end. I had the opportunity to serve in the Parliament. I did a number of tasks as the Special Envoy for Human Rights, securing Australia's election to the UN Human Rights Council. I was able to be the mayor of Hornsby for 7 years after my period in the federal parliament. Public life has always been very important to me, part of my family's heritage.
Philip Ruddock, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.